All right, I'm going to lay this out first and foremost. This is how we're going to do this presentation because I have a lot of information to cover and not a lot of time to do so. I want to give full opportunity to not only give this information accurately, directly, and succinctly, but then we're going to have the chance to watch a video that will, in a sense, be a repetition of everything I'm going to discuss, minus, in a sense, the fallout as far as history goes, and more focusing on the culture, the impact, and the implications of Islam's history. And then we will have the last 10 minutes for questions. So if you could hold all of those till the end, after the video, we'll have the last 10 minutes and that time dedicated completely to questions. And if they aren't answered by then the video, throughout the study and the continuation of the topics, or by myself, you can ask them then. So starting on Islam. Islam is, in a sense, the religion that, of course, as you would know, means submission. Submission, of course, mentioned to Allah in particular, was actually not a phrase coined until 691. Now note, Muhammad died in 632. So the first inscription we have of Islam being the title of the religion of Islam was actually founded on the Dome of the Rock, which is the mosque that is currently erected on top of the Temple Mount. You guys are all familiar with it, nice big gold dome, and it has the inscriptions of Surah 112 on it. That is not begotten, nor does he beget. And all of these different phrases and ideologies were, in a sense, first founded upon these principles that God is one, do not say three. Now again, that is taken directly from the Quran, and that is their understanding of the Trinity. The term Muslim is also a newly coined term following the death of Muhammad. The original identity of Muslims, followers of Muhammad and submitting to us, to Allah, were actually called Hagarites or Ishmaelites, descendants of Ishmael or descendants of Hagar. So just like, in a sense, we as Christians in the book of Acts were not called Christians until after it was used as an insult in Antioch, we also have that much in common with Muslims. They were not called those who submit to Allah or one who submits until well beyond their prophet's decease. Now, we're also going to go into a little bit of information that you've heard before. You guys know surahs and ayahs, chapters and verses of the Quran. These things are not organized chronologically, but they are organized by length. Now, we're going to discuss not only how these things were revealed and in what order these things should properly be revealed in, but also which way they should be interpreted in based on the historical context, because as Bo said before me, that is the most important thing in understanding how Islam is practiced practically. And then lastly, of course, we're going to discuss a little bit of geography, who Muhammad was, where he was born, where he came from, so on and so forth. And those would be the two main cities that I've listed for you. Mecca, which is the supposed birthplace of Muhammad. Again, I won't get into the questioned history on that matter. If you want more information on this, I recommend Jay Smith's videos. He's a PhD and has done extensive studies on this, where he actually has a lot of substantial evidence to conclude it was actually Petra was the birthplace of Muhammad, but nonetheless, Mecca was the acclaimed birthplace of Muhammad and where the Hajj, the pilgrimage, is generally taken to honor and commemorate his birth as well as his existence being a mercy unto mankind. And then lastly, Medina is the place where he sought refuge from persecution and where, in a sense, he was welcomed in by the Jews in what was originally called Yathrib, later named Medina after he conquered it in around the early 600s. So, starting with Islam, understand that just like us as well, they follow a book and a man. Now, the man was a man named Muhammad. I have no photo available for you this evening because I would be essentially be considered a threat, an insult to the prophet in order to make any likeness of him. Just like we would give the respect towards Yahweh and not making a graven image, they say that any description of the prophet is a blaspheme to his name since Allah has used him in many ways. I'll leave that to your interpretation as to how highly they view him. But he was a man born, like everyone else in existence, who would be considered a part of the human race in 570 A.D. Now note, A.D., this is after the Anno Domini, year of our Lord, after Jesus manifested himself to this world. So he is in Saudi Arabia, and he has been surrounded all of his life by Christianity, which has been well implemented into the Alexandrian trade routes, and as well everything else that the cities and roads of the Roman Empire would provide, at least the what was left of them once the Byzantines were in power. Again, the Eastern and Western split of the Roman Empire, different topic. And during this time, he was orphaned at a very young age, which is rather unfortunate on his part, and it would actually do well to develop a good aspect of his character later on. He was adopted and taken in by a man named Abdullah. That is why Muhammad is referred to as Muhammad bin Abdullah. He is the son of Abdullah, the adopted and patroned taking in of this man who was, in a sense, a prominent elder and leader of what was called the Quraysh tribe in Mecca. Now, the Quraysh, Qureshi, any of you guys are familiar with the Muslim name, generally if you find a Jewish person, they'd be named Goldberg or that kind of deal. It's the general stereotype. I know several Muslims myself who would coin the last name Qureshi, and that's because that was the name of Muhammad's tribe, Quraysh. So with Abdullah essentially being the mob boss of this society, he was the one who was in charge of this trade that would be going through Mecca, which is again historically disputed, but I won't get into details on that. And he married a very old woman. His first marriage was at the age of 25. Now we all know about, he was very polygamous and stuff, but he didn't start out that way. Just like Adolf Hitler, he was a very good man up until this point in history. We have to represent everything honestly. He was monogamous until Khadijah died, and Khadijah was his first wife. She was 45 when they first married him. She admired him for his stewardship and how well he handled finances, and since she was the owner of the business, she in a sense made Muhammad not only her employee but also her steward and entrusting everything to her financially in a society that was actually more matriarchal until Islam essentially founded itself. Now, going on into this detail, it was when Muhammad was 40 years old that he had his first interactions with the spiritual realm. Now, this is according to Islamic lore anyway, Muhammad's interaction with what we know as the angel Gabriel. The Arabic term for him is Jibril. And he was, in a sense, doing what was natural in the Arabian desert to get up to a little bit better altitude to escape the heat of the day. And he found himself asleep. And in a dream, he interacted with this angel. And this angel interacted with him in a very interesting way. And again, I am reading directly from the Muslim sources on this. I encourage you to read along with me if the text is big enough for you. Read along. This is Ibn Ishaq's commentary on the life of Muhammad. So these are Muslim sources on these matters. It was the night on which Allah honored him with his mission and showed mercy to his servants thereby. Jibril brought the command of Allah. I'll use my own notes, it's a little blurry here. He came to me, and said the apostle of Allah, while I was asleep with a coverlet brocade, a writing tool and instruments, and said, read, or recite. I said, what shall I read? So he pressed me so tightly that I thought it was death. Now this is written around mid-1600s, very New King James Englishy, so just follow along with the phrasing. He was crushed by this angel, squeezed with the writing instruments until he thought he was going to die. Then he let me go and said to me, read. I said, what shall I read? So he pressed it with me again so that I thought it was death. Then he let me go and said, read. And I said, what shall I read? He pressed it with me a third time till I thought it was death. He let me go and said, read. I said, what then shall I read? This I said, only to deliver myself from him, lest he do the same to me again. He said, read in the name of thy Lord, who created man of blood coagulated. Read thy Lord most beneficent, who taught with a pen which he knew not unto men. So I read it, and he departed from me, and I awoke from my sleep, and it was as though these words were written on my heart. Now this is the historical background of Surah 96, 1 through 16, the first chapter of the Quran. Now, if you're going to follow with me on this, what could you take away from that spiritual interaction? It was a very unpleasant experience, and every other time the angel Gabriel decided to speak to someone through divine revelations, it was similarly responded to, but not similarly interacted. The angel Gabriel frightened someone out of their wits. Daniel fell on the ground as though dead. Mary considered what manner of greeting was this, especially with the individual that's speaking to me. And then, of course, lastly, when John himself was face to face with our risen Lord, he fell at his feet as though dead. But what was the response? He was given strength. He was encouraged. He said, "Do not be afraid." My favorite verse in the whole Bible, because that was the necessary impression of who he was interacting with as far as a spiritual entity, someone who was a comforter. But Muhammad's revelation with this angel, who claimed to be Gabriel, and I say that explicitly, was with violence, with coercion, and with force. This would be expressive of the spiritual impact that Muhammad would have on the world from that point onward, because it was after this point, in which you heard in David Wood's Top 10 Facts You Need to Know About Islam, that after this, Muhammad became suicidal. He tried to hurl himself off a cliff. We have 36 different sources confirming this, all of which are authentic, and we have basically every kind of historical evidence to believe that this was the case, and it wasn't until a Arestrian Christian, which is a heretical group, by the way, came to him and said, no, you've interacted with an angel. That was Gabriel. I mean, you're a prophet of God. And it was a friend of Khadijah. So a friend of his wife, who was a Christian, who didn't follow proper Christian doctrine, gave Islam the credibility of being from God. Glad that's clarified. Now, this is where the first revelations of the Quran came, following 610 to 622, the following 12 years, and again AD, Anno Domini, following the time of Jesus. The Arabs have had 500 years to have had access and have complete translations, as well as oral traditions anyway, of the completed work of God. They were reading the same Bible that we have today, Genesis to Revelation. Now, of course, as you know, Muhammad was illiterate. Otherwise, I'm sure he would have at least responded to the angel a little bit sooner about his literacy. He remained so until the end of his life. And Bo also brought up to you, he had his own scribe who was given the responsibility of dictating this. He later converted out of Islam and was executed at Medina when he took it over. We'll talk more about that in a second. But this was where the foundations of Islam were introduced. And as I'm sure most of you guys know, the most emphasized detail about the life of a Muslim is their daily prayers. Now, how many guys know how many they're supposed to do in a day? Five. Now, that wasn't originally the case, because Muhammad, who claimed to be a prophet, who is acclaimed and overemphasized to be as such, a messenger of God, does not have any miracles to his name, with the exception of this event, which is called the Miraj. And I'm sure that is why you are wondering, why do I have a picture of Shrek, the donkey from Shrek, flying and mocking the knights from the first movie? Well, that is actually the story. This is a Sahih account, a most trustworthy account of the miracles of the prophet. He had an interaction with a flying donkey that brought him up to the seventh heaven. Now, Islam's understanding is that there are five earths stacked on top of each other and seven heavens above that, and then Allah's throne. And as well, there are seven mountain goats above the seven heavens, and as well a giant whale underneath. So I'm not sure how they justify that geographically and geologically, I believe is the proper term. But with these understandings, it's understandable that a Meccan caravan trader would think these things, but these words are being ascribed to God himself, so I guess they have some credibility in the Muslim world. He traveled to the seventh heaven and was given direct command by Allah and saying, "This is how you properly submit to me, 50 prayers a day." Now, you guys are all saying the same thing he did. He's like, "That's too much." So he went down to the fifth heaven. So obviously we're not talking about atmospheres, we're talking about different locations, where he talked with Moses, and he said, "Yeah, this is what Allah told me." He said, "Well, why don't you go back up and try and get it knocked down a little bit?" So he goes up to the seventh heaven, and Allah says, "Okay, well, how about 45? Then he goes down to the sixth heaven, and then the words echo, "Well, how about 30? And then finally, when he gets down to the first heaven, it's whittled down to 5. So Muhammad is a mercy unto all mankind. You only have to pray 5 times a day, not 50. So that's essentially what happened, and that's why the Dome of the Rock Mosque is claimed to be one of the most sacred sites, because this flying donkey, some other accounts say it was a horse, which is so much better, and they claim that that is where Muhammad ascended into heaven. So, journey on a unicorn, everybody. That's fantastic. Now, this is where, again, first 12 years of Muhammad's life, he was revealing what were called the Meccan revelations of the Quran. This was the most peaceful time in his life. That's where he came up with his argument of literary excellence. He'd come up and stand up in the public square. They didn't have Facebook back then, so if you wanted to make a post, you had to literally stand up and hold a big post-up sign and say, hey, I have something to say. And he'd say, these words are from God. Could you produce any verse like it? And then someone would stand up right after him and say, in what way are my words better than yours? And then so on and so forth, they started to get a little bit frustrated because they weren't winning a lot of converts. There was also a time of a lot of persecution on the part of Muhammad because Muhammad actually had a sizable amount of followers at the beginning of his life, and the persecution they experienced, which the video will emphasize the circumstances of which and why he began to be persecuted for this by the pagans in Mecca, included all of the following. Now, this is the total account of all the persecutions Muhammad endured. Because Abdullah was, in a sense, the godfather of the town, he could provide Muhammad with protection, being his adopted son. That's why no one could touch him. They did mess around with him a little bit. They poured camel guts over him so that he couldn't stand up again after doing his prayers. It was a very predictable time because he exemplified this very strictly for his followers. And 13 of his followers were killed, and as well, there was a lot of contention, so to speak, as far as the poetry that was being written about him at that time, and it hurt his feelings. So that was the amount of persecution Muhammad endured, and it was during this time he decided, I need to find a better place to live, and that is where he went to Hirja, which would be the fleeing, in a sense, of from persecution, the journey that Muhammad made from Mecca to Medina, which was originally called Yathrib. And it was during this time that he decided, now that he was starting to get a little bit of support, that he had the moral superiority of the time, the victim status, if you will, of saying, I've been kicked out of my own home country by my own people, and the Jews that lived in Yathrib were willing to support him and provide him, and while he was preaching this message, he gained a sizable amount of converts. Now, as these numbers grew, he began by getting, in a sense, a little bit of payback on the Meccan trade by attacking the caravans that were the livelihood of the city. As you know, there's not a lot of oases in the desert or water supplies. It's basically just a barren area of desert, so it depends highly upon trade. And by Muhammad attacking these areas, it was, in a sense, denying all livelihood. It would be, in a sense, shutting down all supplies for Costco for us. It would definitely be noticed in the public news, even more so than in our world today, because that was their only means of transport. Now, during this time, Muhammad committed 7 attacks on the caravans, and it was on the 7th time they decided to send an army to defend the caravans, and that was the first battle of Islam's history. Pagans, or non-Muslims rather, trying to defend themselves from Muhammad's acts of violence and terror. And it was during this time that we have the recorded hadith that during the Battle of Badr, this is a direct quotation from Sahih al-Bukhari, I'll talk about what that is in a minute, volume 4, book 52, and hadith number 220, so these are long books. And it says, Allah's apostle said, I have been sent with the shortest expressions bearing the widest meanings, and I have been made victorious with terror. And while I was sleeping, the keys of the treasures of the world were brought to me and put into my hand. Abu Hadara added, Allah's apostle has left the world, and now you people are bringing out those treasures. And what means are you bringing out these treasures? How has Allah placed the treasures of the world in your hand? Through terror. So this was the foundations of Islam being practiced through terrorism. Muhammad himself acclaimed, this is my gift from Allah. This is the way that Allah is speaking through me, as which no prophets before me ever have. So that's the foundations of why terrorists would acclaim to be following Muhammad's example. It was during this time that you could essentially make the argument that Muhammad was only acting defensively, since, again, we'd argue because we are actually reading it, but they would claim that, oh, well, the caravans were carrying Muhammad's possessions anyway, and since he had to leave in such a hurry, it was just justice. And following the Battle of Badr, this was the first confrontation and understanding that Muhammad was now showing his true colors, or at least the colors of the one who had revealed these things to him. Now, you saw the circling of the Kaaba with Bo's video in the first study. It was a very interesting event. And as well, it was a very significant event in Muhammad's life because in 630, following... the Meccan revelations of the Quran, following this time, Muhammad retakes the city of Mecca. He conquers the city of Mecca, but does so without firing a shot. Now, when he had every opportunity to do so violently, when he had established a reputation for himself that even gave the tribes that had been providing him refuge up until this point great caution about trusting him, this was, in a sense, the most peaceful thing Muhammad had done up until the end of his life. Because after conquering the city of Medina, we have the final revelations of the Quran, which are including but not limited to the passages that Bo read to you in the first study, which are including Surah 9, which is the passage that directly tells us, fight those who do not believe in Allah. Those who submit to Allah are superior to disbelievers, and so they fight. Allah has given to you the treasures of the kingdom so that you may have the garden, so they fight in Allah's way. Thus they slay and are slain. Fight those who do not believe in Allah. The kufr are the worst of creatures, and if you interact with them, drive them to the nearest side of the road. So you see a progression of Muhammad's revelation in getting into this almost degenerate anger that set the foundations for the example that Muslims are supposed to follow today. And in a sense, the transition from peaceful Muslims to violent Muslims are those who pick and choose which aspect of Muhammad's life and which section of the revelations they choose to follow. Now, along with this, understand that no one lives forever, and Muhammad's life was limited. Up until this point, he had a number of battles under his belt and quite the large body count. He had beheaded over 800 Jews personally by his own hand, including the raping and slaughtering of anyone that ever stood in his way. And including one of these battles, which is known as the Battle of Khaybar, it was a complete massacre, and it's hesitated to be called in history even a battle, because the people were overtaken without the chance to even prepare their war horses or wake up in the morning. They just, you know, no one said the British are coming. Muhammad arrived, and everyone in the city was completely annihilated. Now, a woman by the name of Zainab bint al-Harith offered to cook dinner for Muhammad after he had slaughtered her husband and her father. And Muhammad accepts her offer. Of course, the lamb was poisoned, and the resulting effects on his body over the next 2 years ended ultimately in his death. Now, the legacy of Muhammad has a lot to speak, because there's more than one half to anyone's personality. And you guys seen the Western film, The Good, Bad, and the Ugly. We got Clint Eastwood up here. Muhammad wasn't all that bad a guy. He definitely progressed into more of a standard that we could follow and come to conclusions about him. But nonetheless, there are good things about him. Muhammad, his impact on Arab society, he firstly spoke against female infanticide. When they were having children, because women didn't really contribute much in the world that they had today, they wouldn't necessarily carry on the family name. They would just, you know, bury the newborn girls in the sand and just forget about it. So Muhammad was pro-choice. We can give him that much. He was very kind to orphans, himself having been one. That much can be said of his character. And he introduced monotheism into Arab culture. Now, even though it was the wrong god, I think it is a commendable thing that you impacted your culture into not saying that morality is just whatever you're feeling in any given day. He set a standard for people that is very close to the truth. So I'd give him credit at least for doing half the work for us, even if it's in the wrong name. Now, of course, there are two other individuals to this title. If we're going to discuss the good with Clint Eastwood, we also have to discuss the bad. Muhammad has a lot of things he has to account for at the end of his life. He is responsible for the slaughter of 3 Jewish tribes, simply because they found out his true intentions after retaking Medina, Mecca rather, and the tribes of Medina were completely wiped out as a result of backing out of an alliance with him. Note, they did not attack him. They just said, look, we don't want in on this deal anymore, and Muhammad considered that an attack. as well he assassinated individuals that spoke out or wrote poetry against him, because intellectual assaults against Islam count as an attack. Bo, Uvaldo, and myself are, in a sense, just as much enemies of Islam as a Delta Force member in Afghanistan. According to Islam, we are due the same punishment as someone who would attack Islam in battle. We are intellectually assaulting someone. So understand their perspective. He cut off all trade from Mecca and made warfare the empire's only source of income by declaring war with Rome. That is the historical context of Surah 929. When Muhammad said, "Fight those who do not believe in Allah," it wasn't for the sake of a pure Muslim society. People were wondering in Surah 924 through 932, that entire passage in its context, was wondering historically, the Muslims were saying, okay, so you cut off you smashed all 99 idols and saved the black stone as the one idol that is actually pointing us to the true God. And you claim this thing was built by Abraham and whatever, all that stuff as being the foundations of Islam. But if 99 idols less, it means 99 less people who are going to come and pay to see these things, how are we going to make money? And so Muhammad said, well, Allah has given us victory over our enemies before. He will do so with the Byzantine Empire again. So he declared war on Rome. And he said, this is how Allah is going to bless us. Oh, excuse me. So all these things being pointed out, you saw the last point being made there. And then lastly, of course, the foundations of his society were to be built on the subjugation and totalitarian oppression of people through a double taxation system that was dikkat for Muslims. Now, this is above and beyond the giving of the alms of the poor. You guys remember the five pillars of Islam, giving to the poor, belief in jinn, understanding the Allah is his messenger, or Allah is the only God, and Muhammad is his messenger, pilgrimage to Mecca, and of course, natural submission to Allah, the pilgrimage and Hajj, and all that kind of stuff. The six articles of faith, belief in prophets, Allah, the oneness of God, tawheed, that is the commandment, the observance of everything in all the divine holy books, so on and so forth. This was Muhammad's way of giving a livelihood for the people, and it would generally add up to around 40% of your livelihood. So if you think it's tough to pinch pennies in our day, living under Muhammad implied a 40% taxation on average for people living in Islamic lands. And we'll talk more about this when we get into Abu Bakr and Uthman. But lastly, if you were a non-Muslim and lived in Muslim lands, this is where the oppression comes in. You are required a minimum 50% tax called jizya, and note that is on the gross, not the net, of everything that you own in exchange for not being executed for living in Muslim lands. Naturally, it is a form of humiliation. One of Muhammad's companions said, when you take the jizya from the unbelievers, the kufr, and this is just the Christians and Jews, by the way, don't even ask what they do to atheists, they would do so with them stepping on the back of your neck as you bow your head to them with your nose in the dirt. So, quoting him directly, it's not exactly a complimentary exchange of government funds. And of course, we have a third member, the Ugly. He personally slaughtered and beheaded 800 Jews. He required, according to the Quran, divinely revealed from Allah, four wives, assuming you could treat them equally. He is historically assumed to have 9 to 11 at one time, and they even brag about this in their Muslim sources with words I will not repeat here. He married a 9-year-old girl. Of course, he consummated his marriage with a 9-year-old girl. She was actually committed to him in marriage at the age of 6, and the accounts do confirm she was still playing with dolls, and according to Arab culture, you are required to stop playing with dolls the moment you have hit puberty. So yes, Muhammad did rape a prepubescent girl. That cannot be denied, but that is not something that is ashamed of by most Muslims in the day. What they are ashamed of is his marrying of Zainab, which was the wife of his adopted son. Now, the circumstances around that were utterly hilarious. You can ask me about it some other time. But for the sake of time, I'll also point out the fact that Arab culture has set the foundations for race-based slavery in the Middle East, throughout Northern Africa, and even to this day as a cultural rule. Muhammad owned black slaves. He said that basically the worst kind of Muslim leader that you would have is an Ethiopian whose head looks like a raisin. He is not exactly a politically correct figure, and he is probably, and I guess I would quote James White on this, he's more white than Joseph Smith as far as his implications and impact on the world scene. So all these things being pointed out, the legacy of Muhammad is not just in his life, but also in his followers, because after being poisoned by that leg of lamb, he passed on everything to his non-existent son. All of Muhammad's children had died before they had reached full age, so obviously he had to pass it on to a near relative. And since Muhammad was orphaned, who do you think would be the first person to gain his authority? The in-laws. Now this is where we get into the first four caliphs, because the first successor of Muhammad was not actually a blood relative, it was Aisha's father. There we have a picture of him. His name was Abu Bakr, the first rightly guided caliph and Muhammad's favorite wife's biological father. And he was also one of Muhammad's original disciples, so he had some sort of semblance to be able to claim what the Quran was in its original intent. He set the seeds for the apostate wars, as you saw with Bo's presentation, but it was most implemented with the next one, Umar. He obviously didn't hang around for very long, 632 through 634. I do subtraction properly, that's only 2 years. Fortunately, at least for him, he is the only of the first rightly guided caliphs to die from natural causes, and that will be clear here in a minute. He passes all authority on to Umar, who was another one of Muhammad's in-laws. Of course, he had many wives, so obviously he had many father-in-laws. He was another one of them. And there he is right there, looking very pious, I think. I guess that's what they look like in Islamic piety. He had a little bit more of a longer stretch, 634 to 644, that's a full 10 years, and he is the one who introduced the apostate wars. Now, the reason why Abu Bakr passed on his authority to Uthman is because he considered him the most trustworthy, the most passionate in his pursuit and dedication to Islam and as far as it was revealed to Muhammad. And it was especially over the matter of taxation. Now, how do we recognize a false prophet within our own church? Is what do they say about the money? Well, Umar is famously quoted in saying, if an individual doesn't take as seriously zakat, the pain of taxation, by Muslims as passionately as they would dedicate themselves to their prayers, they are next to a kufr. They are an unbeliever if they don't pay me what they owe. So a little bit of a revelation there about these guys' character. And more people were killed within their own religion than could probably be said of them on their raids in Europe over the next 1,000 years. So, very bloody time in Islam's history. And of course, if anyone disagreed with him on any form of doctrine, particularly that of finance, they were killed. And his cause of death was assassination. You can take your guesses as to why. The third rightly guided caliph was Uthman. Now, Uthman was the individual who gave us the Quran. He is the first one who took it upon himself to give us the written codex. If you were to ask, what kind of Quran are you reading today? He said, there's only one. This is the Uthmanic Quran. There is none like it. It's the same one that was given and written to Muhammad. This is the collective gathering of all the bones, fragments and memory aids that the people who would dictate the Quran, which of course you guys know is what the Quran means, dictation, recitation, the word of Allah. And he's the one who gathered it together. And after an interesting conflict that was known as, and I'm not kidding you on this, the Battle of Yomama. Get it out. The idea Uthman had in his head was, because Allah's word promises to preserve his word, we have a collection of individuals who have the Quran memorized, and it's this collective memory of people that give us the Quran. So if I just put all of these people in one collective army, they're divinely protected. I got an invincible army. So he sends them into battle, and they're hopelessly slaughtered. So he has to come to a conclusion on this and says, okay, so almost 90% of our people who were giving us the Quran are pretty much dead. How do we avoid losing our Quran? We don't want to end up getting confused like the Christians and Jews have over their scriptures. I'm quoting him on this. And so he said, gather all together everything that you could possibly get about the Quran He compiled his own codex and said, this is the true version, burn the rest. That's a problem, because don't you think there is some credibility to be said the same of our scriptures with over 40,000 manuscript evidence based off the majority text? We could then look into what the earliest accounts were writing, compare it to later accounts, see how the message has been preserved or not so much, and say, here are the false, here are the true. Well, Uthman doesn't give us that luxury, because the only evidence we have of the Quran is his own personal copy, and he personally hunted down and killed anyone who said that there was any other such thing than what he thought was the Quran. And by the way, speaking personally from Muhammad, guess what the hadith say? That Umar was last on Muhammad's list as far as dependable sources for the Quran. Take of that what you will. Sahih al-Bukhari, volume 6, book 61, hadith number 510 says that this is a historically acknowledged event in Islam. Now, he did many other things as well, but you need to understand irony of ironies. His death was actually with him reading the Quran. We have his copy today with the bloodstains of the person who hacked the back of his neck with him laying across the Quran as he was reading it. So he puts together his Bible and he's killed on top of it. That's interesting. Now, Uthman's copy, there it is. Those are the bloodstains. We have this today. They won't let many people see it because they'll realize the Quran they're reading and that one are different, but that's another topic. Fourth rightly guided caliph, and this will answer one of your earlier questions, was the founder of what is known as Shia Islam today, because the Sunnis do not acknowledge him as a rightful successor. Ali was not chosen by Uthman. He was elected by a separate council because of the amount of scandal, disagreement, and uproar that was going around because of Uthman's copy of the Quran. So Ali was elected as an individual who upheld the true view of Islam, therefore Shia, and those who held true to the lineage of the imams that were directly selected by those who descended from Uthman. And again, I won't get into those who were chosen beyond this point, but this is where we see the Sunni-Shia split. Ali is the one whom the Shias adhere to, and he is the one whom they acknowledge as the rightful successor to Muhammad. Now, he was nominated as a caliph by a private council. He basically declared war against those who followed the original caliphs, calling them apostates, and he fought a number of battles which are very significant historically in Islam, most of which is known as the Battle of the Camel, where he actually rode to war against Aisha, who had an army behind her. Now, who do you think would have more of an idea of the Quran's message, and who do you think the Muslims would surround themselves behind other than Muhammad's favorite wife? Obviously, he was spending a lot of time with her. I won't tell you doing what, but he had a good idea, or she rather had a good idea of what the Quran was all about, its true intention. She knew personally the voice of the Prophet. So this is who the Sunnis were following, and at the Battle of the Camel, he defeated her and put her under house arrest until the end of her life. She lived to be a good old age. And of course, later on after this, a lot of scandal and rumors started to spread about his emails, so on and so forth, and he was assassinated because they blamed him for Uthman's death. Now, this is, in a sense, the origins of Islam leading to 661 as far as people. But again, there are two followings in this religion: the person, the man, and the what? The book. What happened to the Quran? Well, obviously, we saw what happened with Uthman, but the Quran is only how much percent of Islamic belief? Not much. 14%. Where did these things called the Sunnah and the Hadith come from? 14% of Islamic doctrine, practices, and traditions come from the Quran. The rest and the majority are found in the Hadith and the biography of the Prophet, the Sunnah of Muhammad. Now, firstly, starting with the Quran, Jibril revealed the Quran in 24 visits to the Prophet. I guess he needed to take a bathroom break or something, but in the eternal scene, this was lengthed out. And of course, the Quran is revealed not according to historical context or even doctrinal context, but length of verse. It would be the equivalent of us reading the Bible and the first verse was Psalm 119, verse 1. And then the next chapter would be Numbers chapter 23 and verse 1. And you wouldn't be able to make heads or tails of this, because at one moment you're talking about David's praise of God, then you're talking about financial information as far as how Israel is to be responsible in representing God as a nation that actually knew what they could and couldn't handle, so on and so forth, going down to probably, I don't know, the book of Philemon as the last book of the Bible. So we take all these things into consideration. We have to say, so what order is it? Now, for time's sake, I'm not going to go into this, but you can tell what a mess. Surah 96, Surah 68, Surah 73, 74, 1. Okay, so at least we're sort of at the beginning. And these were just the revelations given to him in Mecca, the first peaceful chapters of the Quran. And you would notice that's a majority. So when Muslims say that the Quran is an inherently peaceful book, or it's a generally neutral about conflict style of book, these are historically the first chapters revealed to Muhammad. And it's the good majority of the Quran, the first, I believe it's 87 chapters of the Quran, are all dedicated to a concept and idea that Allah will one day punish non-believers, but coexist until then. Now, this is when those things were written. Now, you also need to understand there is an extreme dependence on knowing when something is said in the Quran and reading it in order to understand that this isn't just complete nonsense. Because if anyone reads a book, where do you generally start? Chapter 1. Then where do you go? What a concept. Muhammad did not organize it this way, and if I'm going to turn up to Genesis chapter 1 and verse 1, I'm like, oh, here we are. That's the problem. Now, going on from this point, the Medinan revelations is where he started to get a little bit defensive. He started to attack the Meccan caravan, and of course this resulted in some of the more subtly violent passages, but more unclear about the matter, and this is generally what are referred to in apologetics, and people say, well, you don't understand what that means. I mean, what could he possibly be referring to in that? And then we look at the historical context and say, oh. Going on to that point, when he finally took over Medina, the last revelations of his life were very violent. Surah 98 through Surah 110, Surah 9 was the most significant of which, where he gave direct orders in his final revelation and sermon. The book of Deuteronomy, according to Muhammad, was fight those who do not believe in Allah. The Jews say that Ezra was the son of God, and the Christians say Isa is the son of God. They are full of error, and they deserve nothing but utter hellfire. And just this endless rant about slaughtering infidels wherever you find them, and the exact implications of what it means to fight those who do not believe in Allah, slay and being slain. So, understanding the context when these things are written, I also understand now for the hadith literature. The hadith, of course, as Bo discussed very briefly, are the sayings, the records of the life of Muhammad, and they are organized into three categories. Now, these were not recorded based off of written manuscripts, libraries. Muslims do not like reading, they like listening. They prefer iPods, not textbooks, so if they're going to get a record of something, they'd have to go and ask someone who heard about that once. Now, how dependable is that information? Now, if they're going to assess this information, this was actually first taken into account by Imam Bukhari, who wrote Sahih al-Bukhari, and he is the one who collected the most trusted sayings of the life of Muhammad. And this is the first and most expansive of the hadith literature. Sahih al-Bukhari was written in 870 AD. Now, do the math with me here, folks. When did Muhammad die? 632 AD. How long did Muhammad's disciples and closest people actually live to see and hear what he said, who had firsthand experience about the things that he spoke and taught? How long did they generally live? Probably less than 700 AD, especially considering how the caliphs fared. 870 AD is the first record and writings of his life. It would be the equivalent of saying that up to almost 200 years after the life of Jesus, we have the book of Acts. How many of you would trust that? The atheists would have a field day stomping on this, but we don't threaten to behead them if they say a word against our book. So, again, take that how you will. There are three categories of trustworthiness: Sahih, meaning most trusted; Hasan, which is somewhat trustworthy; and Da'if, which is a weak hadith. I mean, it was said about the Prophet once, but we don't know where it really came from. They did some record, an idea of this, and their intention, Sahih, Imam Bukhari, that was his name, Imam is a title of a leader in a Muslim group, gathered these things and said, well, where'd you hear that from? Then he'd travel and he'd go to that person and said, this is what this person told me, is that true? And then where'd you hear that from? And then they'd ask, probably that person was dead at that point, so they'd say, like, they'd ask his family or his children, where did he hear that from? And if they could get it down to a companion of the Prophet, at least by what they claimed, then it was considered sahih. It couldn't go that far, but at least had some credence to be approaching that point. It was Hassan, and if someone just said something about the Prophet and it sounded all right, they'd throw it in there. It's da'if. It's weak, but it's in there. And that's why these books are so long. We're told about what shade of skin the Prophet's armpits were. We're told about how the Prophet went to the bathroom and his intentions in doing so. It's completely... Well, it's a very interesting read, to say the least. I will never get those hours of my life back. But after that, his student, Imam Muslim, compiled Sahih Muslim, and the same deal. It is not as long as Bukhari, but if it's considered in both hadiths, then it is also considered grounds for being a Sahih level of trustworthiness. And then lastly, the first Sunnah, the first biography of Muhammad, the first gospel, according to Muhammad, was written in 923 A.D., the history of At-Tabari, as the first verifiable and historically confirmed biography of the Prophet. This is all we know about the historical context and credence of the Quran, written almost 200 to 300 years after the fact. Am I telling you this so that you can point it out to Muslims and say you have no grounds for this, like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens? No, I'm saying you need to know where these people are coming from. They're told to believe something. They don't have reason to believe it. Now, finishing off this time, I had a field day in discussing this. Unfortunately, we're not going to get too much additional time for questions. I'd like to take those now, and then we're going to get the chance to watch a video regarding the three stages of jihad, I trust. So if anyone has any questions, could you please ask them now? Yes? Was Uthman a father-in-law of Muhammad? Yes, Uthman was a descendant of one of Muhammad's in-laws. He didn't have direct relations to any of Muhammad's wives, but he was considered a trustworthy source. He was directly anointed or appointed to the role by Umar, who was a father-in-law of Muhammad. So I don't know about his relation to Umar, but he trusted him to uphold the Quran. He was one of Muhammad's disciples. I don't know about his relation, though. So your question is, how do they view Israel or Jacob if they revere Abraham so highly? Now, I'm sure you're referring to, with the Dome of the Rock, they make a lot of these interesting claims about saying that, oh, it was Abraham and Ishmael who created the Kaaba and set that foundation. That's why we worship it, because it was directly given to them by Allah, and that Ishmael was the child of promise, so on and so forth. How do they view Jacob? Well, they view Jacob just as much as they would view Esau, just like they would view any of the other 9,000 prophets whom they can't name. But Muhammad claimed that of all the messengers given to Allah throughout history, they number in the thousands: Abraham, Ishmael, Jacob, the 12 sons of Israel, the 12 sons of Esau, all of this inclusive, are just simply one of many messengers of Allah, and Muhammad is the capstone that finalizes all of their information. So the Muslim view of the prophets, including Jacob, is that they are a messenger of Allah. They view Jacob just like they view Jesus. Oh yeah, he spoke from God. Peace be upon him. That's what they'll say. The Sirah is the biography of Muhammad, referring to the question, does that refer to the recordings of Muhammad and generally what Muslims don't read? Most Muslims haven't read the Hadith, and a lot of Muslims haven't even read the Quran. They're just told a lot of verses by the Imam, and they assume, like sadly most Christians, oh yeah, I hear the Bible every week, I've read it. All right, well, I'd like to thank you for your time. I hope this information is something that God can use in your conversations with Muslims.